Welcome to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. I'm your host, Jace Kraft, and today on the show, I am interviewing Johnny Owens. Owens has been applying personalized blood flow rehabilitation training clinically since 2012 and credits the modality with significant strength recovery in all of his patients. He has taken part in numerous research projects involving regenerative medicine, sports medicine, and rehabilitation of combat casualty. Owens has been published extensively in peer-reviewed literature, and his work has been featured on 60 Minutes, Time Magazine, NPR, Discovery Channel, and ESPN. Today, we are here to learn all about blood flow restriction, known as BFR. You'll hear us use that term multiple times throughout the interview, how it can be used and the effects on the body as well as recovery and what this could mean for you and your training. Let's get into it.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Hey, Johnny. Great to have you on the show, man.
Jace, thanks for having me, man. Great to be on.
Awesome. Well, I want to start with your just sports kind of history of Johnny Owens, the athlete, prior to your professional career here. So where did sports start for Johnny?
Yeah, well, I don't have a glorious sports history, I guess I'll say, but I'm from Texas and I grew up in West Texas. So it's mandatory that you play football here, and also kind of mandatory in my household, you played every sport. And so I played them all, but soccer was really the one that I liked the most. I broke my dad's heart in high school and said, you know, I'm giving up football. I didn't want to get hurt because I was actually getting pretty good at soccer. So I made it up to playing, and we had a semi-professional league that I was able to play in, and then also played at University of Texas. So, and then I hurt myself multiple times and multiple knee surgeries playing soccer. So maybe I should have stuck to football.
Yeah. I hear that soccer is one of the highest like injury prone sports when compared to all of them. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, or you know, well, it was for me, unfortunately, but it's football has, you know, what we call kind of high energy injuries. And so these guys are just like heat seeking missiles. So, you know, if you look at the spectrum from fractures to ACLs to tendon to concussions, I would gather that football is probably higher, but overall maybe injuries, you know, soccer probably has a high incidence just from the amount of hamstring injuries and soft tissue injuries. I mean, that's a lot of playing time. And you're also cramming, you know, now in the leagues, you're playing multiple games a week, lots of times. So there's a lot of volume issues.
Sure. Sure. When did you make the switch from football to soccer?
Yeah. My freshman year in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm up north in South Dakota here. My brothers went from football to cross country their freshman year. And I was so mad at them because football was the way for me. You know, I was their younger brother, I wanted to follow in their footsteps, and then ended up liking cross country better. And that ended up being my sport was endurance running rather than football. I never even played football, but I was so mad at my brothers for not doing it.
they ruined you. The Dakotas, man, they put up some good football up there. So
yeah. So cool. So you said you played some semi-professional soccer. Yeah. How long of a career and how'd that go for you?
Yeah, it was short. So I started my senior year in high school. And so there was a new league that started up, and it was my city, which was Lubbock. Denver had a team, Austin, Phoenix. So it was pretty cool. Like in high school, my senior year, I'm flying around all over the place, playing these games. That's our awesome coach was really rich. He's a German guy that played over there in the Bundesliga, and he became a really big grocery store kind of tycoon. So he had his own like Learjet that, you know, if we couldn't ride on the buses, you know, we had to work or school or something, he would fly us out on that plane. So that was pretty fun. And so then I went to Texas Tech here in Lubbock my freshman year in college and still played because I was still here locally. And then I transferred to the University of Texas because I realized Austin's way cooler than Lubbock, Texas. And so, that's when it ended when I moved.
Sure. Yeah. Did you see any sort of like blood flow restrictive practices throughout your career as an athlete prior to your professional career?
No, not at all. Well, I'm old. So, you know, I don't think it was really being used at all back when I was doing, you know, sports and things like that. So I'm 50 now. And really, BFR has kind of only taken off in the last few years. Mm-hmm. So there are some older papers where it was used more in the lab type setting.
Sure.
You know, the oldest paper, and so I was with the Department of Defense, and we really vetted this. The oldest paper we could find was actually from 1937, where they kind of did a modified version of it. So it's been around, but clinically or for performance in America, it's really novel and fairly new.
Sure. Cool. So we're going to center this conversation around kind of the physiology behind BFR and what that can what it's supposed to do, what it's been proven to do, and also kind of drawing the line between theory and what has, you know, been proven through kind of the research and stuff. One of the first things I want to dig into is the production of mitochondria, because through the research that I was looking at, it seems that BFR has some promise to either increase the amount of mitochondria or enlarge the mitochondria in the cells. Can you speak to a little bit, like just give us a brief overview of what mitochondria is, just in case somebody needs to go back to science class for just, you know, 30 seconds. And then like, why is this important and what have you seen?
Yeah, sure. So I don't think I've been asked to describe mitochondria in decades maybe. So mitochondria are basically, you know, they produce the energy. So the, it's a little organelle that's within our cells, you know, takes our food sources and moves it down its cell walls and what's called the electron transport chain. And it converts that to energy. Typically it's what you know as ATP. It also spins off some of those electrons and creates the free radicals that are sometimes not the best thing for us. So that's mitochondria in a nutshell. It's a fascinating little structure because it's got some of its own DNA. So we have this thing that lives in us that is probably from something that was outside of our body. They think a big cell might have ate a little cell a long time ago, and the mitochondria started helping that big cell. And so now we've got this weird foreign structure in our body with its own DNA. Yeah.
That's funny. So more or less, it's kind of the energy source of the cells, or what at least produce the energy and stuff. So what has what is BFR? Well, maybe we should back up a little bit and just say like what BFR is. Like how would I know a BFR workout or exercise compared to just a normal one?
Yeah, so most of us are always going to exercise in what we say free flow conditions. That means we're, you know, we want to exercise and allow as much blood to move to our limbs as possible. Mm-hmm. And most people would say that's a good thing. So BFR kind of flips that on its head. And it essentially is we just block the blood from going into the limb. So we either put these cuffs on the proximal thigh or the proximal arm, and we reduce the arterial flow so that you limit oxygen supply and blood into your limb. And it takes very little pressure to block the venous return. So we reduce arterial flow and we completely block the venous return.
Awesome. So you're kind of pooling up blood then?
So there is a pooling because you're not able to push fluid back past the tourniquets. And so, the limb will actually be swelling. The blood is getting pulled down there. And we use a system that has a Doppler technology in it. So we really limit the amount of arterial blood flow that goes in. Lots of times when we're using this in the lower extremity, you know, we're only allowing 20% of your arterial blood flow to go in. So it's a real hypoxic state.
Yeah.
And what it does then is it allows you to exercise at minimal to no load. So typically, you know, the sweet spot is around 20 to 30% of a one rep max if we're talking resistance training.
Sure.
And you do that low load, but you do high volume. So we're typically exercising per kind of target muscle about 75 reps worth. And so what we see from a resistance side is that gives us similar benefits in muscle quantity and quality. So strength and muscle size to lift in heavy. You can also, and so that's beautiful for, you know, rehab scenario. So if you just had surgery, you know, most patients can't lift heavy. Most of our guidelines say you should be lifting heavy if you're going to be able to increase muscle size and muscle strength. So this allows us to kind of hack that and work around it.
Sure.
We also can do this from an endurance standpoint. And so what that means is we do very low loads, such as walking or cycling. And we'll use the same tourniquets on the limbs to reduce flow there. And that's where we can see adaptive changes, not only in the muscle tissue, but also even in things like VO2.
Okay. So what application would you suggest for like BFR? Like, what have you seen it? Is it just in recovering from, surgeries and major kind of injuries, or have you seen it been used in some sort of exercise regimen in healthy populations as well?
Yeah, we've seen it in both. So I think if you look at the evolution of BFR, it was this kind of bench work type stuff, a lot of physiological labs looking at it early on and trying to, you know, understand even, you know, kind of what we call fast twitch muscle fibers, just to make the term easy, anaerobic versus aerobic metabolism. You know, one easy way to do that was just, okay, let's put a tourniquet on and reduce the blood flow. So it was done a lot in the labs, and people were starting to see some really interesting kind of changes that were happening there. And then, it next kind of moved into the clinical setting. And so I think that was the next transition. It made the most sense. We in the DOD started to apply it really in that 2010 to 2012 timeframe is when we started really tinkering around with it, started doing quite a few trials, published some papers. Now there's trials all over the world going on in a clinical setting. And now we're seeing it's really getting a lot of question of how can we do this for performance, or is this a way, recovery is kind of a catch-all term, but you know, maybe people could recover faster. And so that's probably the most unknown, but it's, you know, we're maybe getting the most questions on that right now.
For sure. So let's go, taking the concept of you're limiting the blood flow into the specific body area that you're working and then limiting it going out. So you're kind of getting that, the blood that's there is doing the work essentially. What type of physiological applications should that entail?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. So you can look at it from, okay, what's the muscle having to do, and also even like what's this hypoxic event doing as well. And so, you know, if you want to go back to mitochondria, you know, you think from an endurance side, you know, that the more mitochondria you have, the better. They're continually turning over ATP. So you're able to maybe go longer and use that energy source. So there's two things you look at. There's either, do you increase mitochondria in content, the density of them, or do you change the biogenesis of the mitochondria? So maybe you make it work a little bit better. And so the hard part is, you know, a lot of that isn't measured directly. So, you know, you'll use these markers to measure mitochondrial kind of respiration or gene expression and say, well, it's up, so we think there's change in mitochondria, but sometimes it's hard to say, do we have more mitochondria there? But the mitochondria live within your muscle cells. And so, you know, one just really landmark paper Jacob Nielsen's group did in Denmark is they did 3 weeks of BFR training and showed that the muscle stem cell, we call it a satellite cell, really increased a lot compared to work match control. So they use this 30% one rep max. They were just doing leg extensions. And then they, on muscle biopsies, they showed that there was more muscle cell content. And so if you say, well, there's, you know, maybe several hundred mitochondria in one muscle cell, if you're showing that I can make these muscle stem cells come out by this hypoxic event, and then they become new muscle cells themselves, then you're increasing mitochondrial density as far as we know. And so, you know, there's quite a few papers that just show that we see improvements in things like VO2. Whenever you wear the tourniquets and ride a bike at a low pace or just walk on a treadmill. And so some of those VO2 changes could be, were maybe increased mitochondrial density. Sure. It could be that little bit of stress. So lots of times cells like some stress, it makes them perform better. The stress of reduced oxygen might also be improving the mitochondrial biogenesis. Mitochondria uses oxygen to do what it does. And so it's having to look for other substrates to maybe, you know, make that happen. So it gets a little bit tougher. So that's a physiological response. There's other things that can also be, you know, I mean, I'm just kind of rolling with your recovery type, kind of flow here. Is there's things that happen when you're in this hypoxic state. So one, you know, the Nobel Prize in 2019 was for three physiologists who showed that if you reduce the oxygen level around cells, you can really manipulate gene expression. And so when you put the limb into hypoxia, that hypoxia releases this thing called hypoxia-inducible factor 1A. And what HIF1A does is it basically releases this whole kind of downstream effect that creates angiogenesis. So you increase capillary beds within the muscle as well. And so the more you're perfusing muscle with capillary beds, that's great from a recovery perspective. It's probably great from an athletic perspective. Mm-hmm. It's great from a clinical patient perspective as well. And even the stress of reducing the oxygen, reducing the blood flow into the artery, and then letting all that release and you get the shear stress, that also has this effect to help with the endothelium of the arteries or the inside lining of the arteries, and also creates this angiogenic effect.
Yeah.
So just there alone, you know, just that hypoxic state, we're increasing potential capillary beds, and we're also maybe driving more mitochondria.
Sure. Yeah. So what it sounds like you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, but really the sweet spot are what's really happening with BFR is we're limiting the oxygen flow, which then provides all this different benefits because your muscle has to work with less oxygen. So it improves efficiency all around, not just mitochondria, but also in like capillaries and that kind of stuff. Is that kind of what you're saying there?
Yeah. And it's a short acute bout typically of reduced oxygen. So short amount of stresses like this, again, it's called hormesis. The body, you know, responds to that. So the resistance exercise itself, you know, when you're doing it is typically about a 6 minute hypoxic kind of event. So really actually pretty acute, but that drives all sorts of things. And one also thing to think about is you're exercising at low intensities or low loads, but that reduced oxygen forces your body to have to use the anaerobic pathway and use fast twitch fibers. So you're tapping into those fast twitch fibers without actually having to do high intense exercise or heavy loads. Sure. And when you tap into the fast twitch fibers, there's this whole just kind of benefit you start to see from the anabolism that happens. Even things like muscle protein synthesis, we've seen over and over in the BFR studies is driven up significantly higher.
Sure. So does this then, like you're talking about fast twitch fibers, is this only beneficial for speed and power athletes, or is there endurance component to this as well? Knowing that I'm assuming you wouldn't want to, you know, put on some BFR cups on your legs and go out for, you know, a 10 mile run. I'm assuming maybe that's been done. I don't know.
No. If it is, you shouldn't do it ever again.
Yeah.
You might only do it once. Yeah. Well, what's interesting is when you look at some of these biopsy studies, you get both fiber types that are work. Mm. So slow and fast twitch. So it's kind of forcing your body to make sure, you know, and your body uses both anyways, but we get to really kind of maximize both of them. I think from an endurance standpoint, the endurance protocols might be the best way to go. And so that would be, you know, either going at a low load, or a low steady state, like something on a bike, you know, doing something, you know, 30% VO2 max type thing with the cuffs on, or if you want to, you know, do like some sprint interval work, it's been shown that that's been beneficial too, where you do sprint interval work. And then you, during your rest period, you put the cuffs on and you cause this kind of trapping of all those muscle metabolites. And so that's another way, if you kind of want to work high intensity and also get this extra benefit. So yeah, you know, elite rowers, there was a study where, you know, they did BFR, or the control group did the exercises without BFR. VO2 max change. They moved the needle pretty, I think it was like 7 to 9% or something of VO2 max in elite individuals. Cause that's the thing that's, we're kind of really interested in that with this, cause it, the more well-trained you are, the harder it is to make adaptation.
And 7 to 9% in elite population is way different than 7 to 9% to the, you know, Joe Schmo.
You can take Joe Schmo any day and just put him on a protocol and train them up, and you can see some changes. But yeah, these other folks, you know, and you try and add more volume to them, and it still barely does anything. And then when you add more volume, that's when you start to get in this kind of injury spectrum potentially. So this looks like it could be an interesting, you know, extra stimulus that maybe, you know, your body isn't used to make this adaptive changes. Even when you're reducing the venous return, or blocking venous return, that cardiovascularly does things to individuals, because the cardiac output equation is cardiac output is heart rate times stroke volume. And so when you block the fluid going back to your heart, that reduces the stroke volume side. So you're, even though you might just be walking on a treadmill, your heart rate is up significantly higher, because the cardiac output equation always wants to maintain itself. So you can take individuals, work at really low intensities, and, and it's forcing their body to actually feel like they're working out much, much harder from an endurance profile.
So you mentioned kind of that 6 minute realm as far as length of exercise on the cuff. Is that like, maybe just what I'm trying to get at is walk us through kind of what a BFR workout may look like compared to a free flow. Is that what you called a
Or you just say regular workout?
Regular workout.
But well, and we put a position stand, or we had to change the title on it, a paper with a bunch of BFR researchers from around the world it's in Frontiers in Physiology. It's open access, anyone can get it. And so we kind of put these parameters out that we see that are used the most and seem to work. So most people, when they're doing a resistance exercise, they you want to try and get to around 20 to 30% of a one rep max, if you can figure out what that is. Let's just say you're on a leg press or something. So you would work in that 20 to 30% one RM zone. And then the most published and just seems to work kind of sets and rep scheme is a set of 30 followed by three sets of 15 with 30 second rest periods in between. And so if you're doing that one, two up, one, two down on the press for 30 second rest, 15, 30 second rest, that equals around 6 to 6.5 minutes of total occlusion time for that exercise. Then you deflate it, get a little bit of a rest period. And then if you want to do another target muscle group, you inflate and go again. That's the resistance side. And again, we're basing the reduction in blood flow off the artery. So we typically do that between 60 to 80% of reduced arterial flow. The endurance side can either be done steady state. And so those have gone anywhere from 15 to 45 minutes of just spinning on a bike or walking on a treadmill, and trying to get these kind of VO2 changes. Or it can be done in an interval fashion where you're just putting the cuffs on and doing low load intervals. Or it can be done in a rest period fashion where you go more high intense and then you put the cuffs on in the rest periods. And kind of all over the place, we've seen VO2 from Division I college basketball players to elite pararescuers to healthy individuals has been increased whenever you do BFR in these aerobic capacities compared to low load.
Okay. Yeah, it gives us a good kind of overview of strength and power kind of versus endurance there. I'm curious to know, and I don't know if this has been studied. I didn't see many articles on it, but you might be able to tell just from your history of working with a tons of athletes and rehabilitation patience. Do you notice, like, if somebody does a regular workout and then versus a BFR workout, is the recovery time relatively the same, or is one quicker than the other?
Yeah. So if you're saying a regular workout, so let's just talk strength again. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to go in, kind of follow these ACSM guidelines for lifting, and so I'm going to go with heavy, say 70% 1RM, like squats or something, that causes muscle damage. And so that's what happens. It's not a bad thing, but there is muscle damage that occurs. And so that's the soreness you're going to feel 2, 3, maybe 4, 5 days later as your body's trying to repair the damage that load put across the muscle fiber. BFR is low load. And so because the load is so low, you're not putting the mechanical stress across the skeletal muscle tissue. Mm-hmm. And so we don't get the muscle damage typically. Now there are some oddballs out there, and there are some cases where it does, but typically you don't. So you're going to feel really maxed out when you're done doing BFR, because it kind of just like takes everything out of the muscle. And you're going to feel fatigued usually for an hour or two. But then, you know, later that day, you'll feel just fine. You can go again. We do it twice a day. So that's a really interesting kind of way to look at it, because the recovery is really quick. And so if I'm, you know, an NBA player and I'm traveling a ton and I've got 3 or 4 games in a week, this is something that you can work in to kind of do the same stimulus potentially as lifting heavy without the downside of a reduced power whenever I'm going to play.
If you stick around and listen to enough of our episodes here on the Science of Sports Recovery podcast, you'll notice a common theme of importance of mobility in recovery and injury prevention. That's why I recommend checking out the Ready States Virtual Mobility Coach to help you improve your mobility, recoverability, and injury prevention. The Ready State is a brainchild of coach and athlete Dr. Kelly Starrett, who you can learn more about on episode 13. His Virtual Mobility Coach program helps athletes understand the importance of recovery, pain relief, and self-care. In other words, it helps fix the recovery side of training so you can keep seeing results from your workouts. His program will guide you through the same mobilizations used on athletes in the NFL, NHL, and MLB. Provide custom tools for pain relief, give you customized pre and post exercise mobilizations based on your training and sports schedule, and deliver daily mobilizations to keep you on track to achieve your goals. You put your heart and soul into your workouts. Make sure you get the most of them by going to thereadystate.com/Jace. Again, that's thereadystate.com/JASE. The link will also be in the show notes. Now, back to the show.
So you had mentioned, like, you do with your patients or clients twice a day. I'm curious to know, in like the studies that show low load with BFR versus high load regular kind of workouts, and the strength gains were relatively the same. Do you know if those, like, the workout sessions, were they the same amount of workout sessions, or do you need to do more sessions with BFR versus just a regular high load?
Yeah. So if you're loading with BFR, you know, in this 20 to 30% rep max range, no, we don't think you need extra sessions, you know, so you can kind of follow this 2 to 3 times a week type of schedule. Sure. And so we used to always feel that, well, lifting heavy is always going to be better than BFR. It seems like you're going to get more strength adaptations. There was a systematic review and meta-analysis came out and said, lifting heavy gets you stronger than doing BFR for the hypertrophy piece. BFR is oftentimes similar to lifting heavy, but probably a better systematic review and meta-analysis from a really well-known lab in Europe just came out this year. And they kind of took the best of the best papers that were well done and also controlled for what we call double dipping when you look at these analysis, and showed that there was no difference in strength gains when they looked at BFR compared to the folks who lifted heavy. So that's new, and that's very interesting, kind of exciting too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I'm just curious, like, if in those studies they had the same amount of sessions, but if you're able to do BFR more often, theoretically, I mean, you should be able to make gains faster, I would think.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, but sometimes more volume isn't always good. You know, it's like I can cook my pizza in the oven at 350. If I put it at 800, that's not necessarily better. Yeah. So the body needs this kind of adaptation time, you know, to go through muscle protein synthesis and make the changes that it needs. So all that extra volume might, you know, what we've seen, probably you don't need it. It matters to us in rehab because some of the studies have really shown that if you really don't lift any load at all with BFR, so that's what we call passive BFR, or you might see it called cell swelling, you probably need to do that more frequently because there's just not as much of a stimulus for an adaptive response. Gotcha. So early post-op, if these pro and college teams or the DOD, where we can see the patients as much as we want, we really like to get them in almost daily. Because we're not increasing strength and size in those cases. We're just slowing the muscle loss train.
Sure. Have you seen or used BFR in like a taper type of phase for athletes where, hey, I don't want to lose strength, but I also don't want to be sore for this, you know, high up, you know, important race or competition? Yeah. And if so, is it just as simple as, you know, taking the workout that they would have done, reducing, you know, by 80%, and then, you know, putting some blood flow cuffs on? Or is there, you know, more of an art to it?
Yeah, no, we've seen it for sure. I've seen it with a lot of the teams we work with, and you know, maybe some of your veteran athletes that, you know, want to be, you know, they got a bum tire in their knee and they just want to be at 100% when the game or season starts. So yeah, so you would taper and choose, you know, if you're like, I want to maintain my strength and hypertrophy gains, and maybe you are doing more of the BFR resistance exercises as you taper down. Or if you're an endurance athlete and you've got a big event coming, then you would want to maybe just, you know, do BFR cycling at a low load to maintain your VO2 and these endurance gains. You know, a really fascinating study, Danny Christensen did it. And what he looked at was if you did BFR at low loads on a bike or the same exercise without BFR on bikes and individuals, 3 times a week for 6 weeks, what does that do for basically how much glucose you would put in your thighs? And so they showed that during that 6 week intervention, the BFR group actually kind of perfused their thighs with more glucose. And then they did a basically exercise test to exhaustion in both groups and compared that to their baseline, and the BFR group performed better. So it could also be, okay, I'm going to taper, and this is also, you know, I'm not getting muscle damage. I'm working on this angiogenic response, maybe mitochondrial density, and I'm forcing more glucose into my thighs. So when you're ready for that event, you're just rocking and ready to go.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
It's a crazy study. I mean, biopsies and measuring blood flow coming out of the femoral artery, and that was a big time study, but it's very interesting.
Yeah. I'm curious to know, as we kind of get close to the end of our conversation, what's like the most excite, like to you personally, why is BFR like exciting to spend all this time on?
I've been a physical therapist for over 20 years. It's one of the first things that just blew my mind when we started applying it in the DOD. Of just the changes we were seeing in individuals. And if you're a therapist and you get someone post-surgery or post-injury, it sucks ass because you're just watching the muscle waste away and you can't do anything because you can't load them. And so to be able to get this on early and just see, you know, sometimes the muscle not go at all, or sometimes even see it improve, that was just crazy huge because we were using it on limb salvage and amputees. So I was, you know, was head the combat casualty care down here at our base, and so we were seeing it on the worst of the worst injuries. Now I think I'm really kind of getting the most excited for the older comorbid things like diabetes and Parkinson's and things like that. You know, if you think about, you can just drive more glucose into the muscle just by doing BFR and some exercise. From a diabetic standpoint, that's huge because all they have is too much glucose or their sugar just running through their system. So We have a trial that we're helping with in Germany where we're looking to see, can this help diabetics? So that group, the older, you know, those older patients, they really tolerate it well, and they show really some fantastic gains.
Awesome. Awesome. And then from a sporting side, where do you think needs to be more research done to like, what's the next step as far as research in BFR? What should we explore?
Yeah. So I think multiple things. For one, is all these kind of things that we're seeing physiologically, do they translate over into improved performance? So that's kind of a missing piece on a lot of this. We're getting these measures and saying, yeah, they're getting their strength back faster, or we're increasing muscle protein synthesis rates. Now we got to see, you know, does that do things like, you know, keep the velocity on an MLB pitcher's fastball? Does that, you know, translate into, you know, a soccer player's ability to move faster? Mm-hmm. And so we're moving that direction. We do have an MLB funded study where we're looking at things like pitching velocities with it. I just submitted a giant grant to see how we can apply it for hamstring injuries in the NFL. Hopefully it gets funded. We'll see. And so there's a lot in that performance space that we really are needing to figure out.
Cool, cool. And then I do want to clarify this just for anybody's listening. If you're thinking like, hey, I want to try BFR, is this something that you can just go on Amazon, buy something, and then, you know, try it out at home? Or, you know, what are kind of the risks if, you know, with this?
Yeah, well, there's always a risk, and especially when you start to reduce blood flow and exercise with it. And so we're starting to get a lot more comfortable as we do this. We're using it on some very injured and diseased populations now. Mm-hmm. What we use in the clinical side and what we use with all the teams and stuff, it's a really pricey unit. You know, it's a medical device. It's got a Doppler. It's got all these kind of bells and whistles, FDA listing and all of that.
Sure.
The buyer beware with everything that's on the market right now. You know, when we were first looking at this, there was no BFR cuffs or anything in the United mm-hmm. States. Now you go to Amazon or Alibaba and there's freaking 900 different ones. And some of them are dangerous. The more narrow the cuff is, the more potential that you can have nerve damage. So the number one injury that you see from tourniquet use is damage to the nerves. And so you don't want to strap something really tight and really narrow, and the next thing you know is you can't feel your fingers anymore because you've demyelinated a nerve. So everybody's had a blood pressure cuff put on them. Mm-hmm. Blood pressure cuffs are FDA listed devices. So if it was me and I'm like, hey, I just want to sample around with something, a blood pressure cuff is an easy thing to do. It won't meet the levels of what we use because blood pressure cuffs are made to drift. So all the pump up-y kind of BFR things you see, eventually they start to just drift. They lose their pressure. Yeah. But that's at least a kind of safe way to dabble your toes in it.
To try it, see how you kind of, you know, feel, and then seek out a professional to help you really like fine tune the, not only the delivery of the workout, but also like what you should work out at.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Cool. All right. Well, if anybody's listening and they're like, hey, I need to follow Johnny, wherever he's at, I need to, you know, get into his business, what he's up to, where should people go and follow along with you?
Probably the easiest one is we have a website. It's owensrecoveryscience.com. And so we have podcasts on there. We just did a one with Dr. Burr that's going to be coming out here soon, where we talk a whole lot about performance enhancement with this. We also have blogs on there. And if you're a clinician, we do teach BFR courses for clinicians that are looking to do this in the medical space. Yeah. And then I'm on social media. I'm not the biggest social media guy, so I'm probably a pretty boring follow, but I think my Twitter's at Johnny Owens CFI. So I'm on there. Sometimes I'll put out some stuff. Yeah. Usually I just try and be funny and no one really thinks it's funny.
It's hard to tell in the digital landscape what's funny or not, because they're all laugh at things and then just scroll by. So, you know, you could be.
I had something. I had like 20 something likes. I told my wife, I'm trending. Oh my God, I'm trending.
cool. And then the name of your podcast, just so anybody's listening, if they're listening to this podcast, they're probably into podcasts. So yeah, let's give it a
it's
shout.
It's really creative. It's Owned Recovery Science Podcast. Same name as our business. Yeah. But we, if you really are into BFR, that's all we do. And we talk with a bunch of my friends and colleagues from around the world who are doing research in this space. So, and we also have, we've had the NFL guys on, MLB, MLS. So we have some of the teams and they talk about the ways they're doing it, NBA as well. So if you're looking at it from a team perspective, it's kind of cool to listen how they're using it.
Cool. Yeah. So if you want to go down the BFR rabbit hole, go check out his podcast.
Yeah.
Johnny, it was great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being on.
Thanks for having me, Jace. Stay safe, man.
All right, episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jace, J-A-S-E, at scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.